swung my fist and shattered its undead face. The creature was knocked aside and fell. Instantly, my hand went numb, and coldness rippled up my arm. I grunted as I did an upside-down sit-up, grabbed the rung above me with my left hand, and pulled. My right arm hanging limply and my knee throbbing in pain, I kept pulling myself along. Push up one rung, lean in, reach up for the next one, repeat. My shotgun shattered as it ricocheted spectacularly off the rail next to my head. Darnay had a good arm.
"That was my favorite gun!"
I bellowed as I kept inching nearer to the hatch. I now had a white on the ladder below, rapidly gaining, and two more scaling the wall to pounce on me. The hatch was still 10 feet away.
"You should have taken my offer!"
the vampire roared. He jumped impossibly high and landed on the ladder directly below me. The metal shook under the impact. Hot water droplets flew off and struck me in the face. Three whites and a vampire in striking distance in the next few seconds. I just kept climbing because that was my only option. I was pretty much screwed. Then the hatch opened, directly above my head. It was my savior. It was Grant Jefferson.
"Grant, help me!"
I screamed, clawing my way toward him. His eyes grew wide as he saw the undead creatures swarming upwards. He started to hold out his hand to me, and then he apparently decided that he did not have time before the creatures would be on him as well. I could see the fear register on his face as he did the math. They were too close. Grant stood in his polished black body armor, bristling with useful weaponry, and said two words. "Sorry, Pitt." He looked right at me as he slammed the hatch.
"Ah!"
I shouted unintelligibly. Darnay laughed below. I stuck one of my legs through the ladder to lock myself into position as well as possible. I reached across my body and drew my pistol with my left hand, sighted on the closest white spider crawling upward, and shot it in the head 4 times before it slipped from the wall and fell 35 feet onto its back with a bone-jarring crunch. The other wall crawler leapt, and I just barely had time to align the front sight on the monster before impact, firing a silver slug through the monster's brain. The white's momentum carried it forward, where it struck one of my legs. It fell away, screaming in rage. Darnay easily avoided the falling undead, but the blind white underneath was not so lucky. The two monsters collided and fell the rest of the way to the hard metal floor. This time they did not rise. My now numb leg buckled, and I only barely held on. Now it was just me and Darnay. He flew up the ladder. I fired the remaining 10 rounds as fast as I could pull the trigger. I hit him repeatedly, but with almost no effect. I dropped the pistol, and he swatted it out of the air. I watched hopelessly as it flew into multiple pieces. I grasped wildly for my knife, but it was too late. He was beside me on the ladder. His clawed hand clamped around my throat like an iron vise, choking off my air. A bullet hole in his forehead closed and squeezed out a mushroomed 45 slug like some disastrous pimple. I learned a few things right then. Vampires did not breathe, and I was in fact still afraid of dying. I was surprised that I was thinking about Julie. I just hoped that she made it.
"Tell me just one thing, you poor brave idiot,"
the vampire ordered as he shook me.
"How did you know about Lord Machado? How?"
"I went to France once," I gasped.
"And what does that have to do with anything?"
Darnay asked, fangs extending as he prepared to feed on me. I wondered if I had the strength to break free long enough to fall to my death. It beat the alternative. My family went there to see where one of my grandpas was buried. He died on Utah Beach. How touching. Now, if you tell me how you learned about Lord Machado, I'll make your death painless. I learned that the people in the countryside were pretty nice, but the people in Paris were a bunch of stuck-up, self-righteous pricks. I'm guessing you're from Paris. Idiot. Darnay's jaw distended as his mouth opened like an anaconda about to eat a goat.
Darnay!
A voice shouted from below. It was Earl Harbinger. He strode into the engine room through the swirling orange smoke. The vampire's mouth slowly closed.
Hello, Earl. It has been a while. Come down here and face me. You know you're not going to get out of here alive. MHI controls the whole freighter. Your goons are all staked. It's over. I have your man as a hostage. Let me go or I kill him,
the vampire hissed.
You know the rules. You helped write them. Let him go and come down here and fight me. You know you've wanted to prove something for a long time. Let's go. Either way, you're going to die. At least this way you get the satisfaction of seeing if I am as good as they say. And what if I just kill this piece of merde?
He squeezed so hard that the vertebrae in my neck popped. I cringed in pain, and involuntary tears rolled from my eyes.
Then I'll have my men at the hatch above you throw down buckets of holy water. I'll just stake you while you're laying on the ground and sizzling. Or even better, I'll tie you up and drag you into the sun. You've seen it. You know how much that has to hurt. I swear that if you kill that hunter, then I'll drag you out of here and nail you to the superstructure and watch you burn. I figure you can probably go a while before you finally quit kicking.
Harbinger unbuckled his armor straps and set his weapon harness on the deck.
Just you and me, Darnay. One last go-round. How do I know you don't have 10 hunters waiting in the hall?
You don't. But you know my reputation.
I do. Fine, Earl. Let us see who the best hunter really is.
The vampire released me and I dropped, barely managing to grab a rail. Darnay let go and fell swiftly to the floor, landing as if it was nothing. The two combatants squared off in the red light and steam. I watched in amazement as Harbinger began to circle. He was just a normal man, maybe 2/3 of my weight, and in training he had never given any indication of having any sort of special fighting skills. On the other hand, I had just watched Darnay perform several superhuman feats and smash my pistol into bits with his bare hands. This did not look good for Harbinger. The hatch creaked open above me. Strong hands reached through and grasped the handles of my armor. The smell of Copenhagen told me that it was Sam Haven. He hung upside down through the hatch and scanned the room. He saw Harbinger and Darnay preparing to fight.
Oh, hell, we've got to get out of here, Sam blurted.
He tugged on me and grunted.
Help me, you hair-lipped derelict. You're too damn heavy.
What about Harbinger?
I asked in a panic.
Don't worry about Earl. He'll be fine. You don't want to be around him when he gets into one of his moods. Now move, damn it!
I struggled up the ladder with Sam pulling me. More hands grasped my arms and helped. Chuck Meade was there as well. The two burly men pulled me into the cargo bay. Sam threw the hatch down and spun the wheel to seal it behind us. The cargo bay was much cooler. The steel of the floor was cold under my face. I lay there for a minute, panting, as the feeling painfully returned to my arm and leg. I could not understand what had just happened. Earl Harbinger had just given up his life for mine. I was sure that Darnay was tearing him to pieces as we sat here uselessly. I gradually pulled myself to a sitting position, my back resting against a sheet metal shipping container, my stomach clenched in agony, and my knee twinged as I moved it.
We have to help him.
Trust me, Pitt. Earl's fine. Too late to do anything now anyways. Let's get up to the weather deck.
What's a weather deck?
Meade asked with a blank stare. The big ranger was splattered with blood, and there appeared to be claw marks on his M249 squad automatic weapon.
Freaking army. The top part of the ship. The part that can see sky.
Oh, okay. Sunlight would be good. I'm unarmed. Darnay broke my guns, I stated as Meade pulled me up.
And that's a sorry state to be in. Here, take this thing. The French guys don't need it no more.
Sam handed me a French FAMAS bullpup assault rifle. It was a slightly unwieldy and strange-looking weapon, but it would have to do. The crew, security team, and hunters have all been accounted for. We should be clear, but you never make no assumptions in this business. Let's get. As we made our way out of the cargo bay, I could not help but ask, "Where is Grant?" Sam scowled, his handlebar mustache scrunching in consternation. He finally spit a nasty clump of chew and shrugged.
"Reckon I don't know. Probably in the light."
"He left me to die," I said hotly.
"Yep, I figured as much.
Some folks are brave when others are watching them, but it is harder to be brave when there ain't no witnesses. Grant's never flaked on us before.
He probably figured you were dead anyway. No use getting killed for no reason. I reckon that Earl will want to talk with him about that."
"Yeah, me too." I cracked my knuckles. I had murder in my heart, and it must have been obvious to Sam. He just smiled.
"Just don't kill him. We're short-handed as it is," the former SEAL pointed out.
"Plus, then Julie would probably shoot you, and you don't want to mess with her." Sam pointedly went back to his radio traffic, warning the others that we were coming out. I could not listen along. Somewhere along the line, my radio had been broken. The daylight was beautiful. The breeze was cool and refreshing. I was surprised at how low the sun was on the horizon. We had been in the dark bowels of the ship forever. It felt good to be alive. Almost all of the hunters were milling around on the deck. Boone's team was somber near the sheet-draped body of their lost man. My team was there. Holly and Tripp rushed to me, hugging me and slapping me on my back. Lee was lying on some blankets, his shirt off and thick bandages encircling his chest. He shouted my name and clapped. Julie was there as well. She quit giving orders long enough to run over and grab me by my armor.
"I'm sorry we couldn't come back for you. There were more of them in the corridor waiting for us. We got jumped. I'm sorry. How did you make it?"
She looked really happy to see me. The feeling was mutual. "Earl saved me. I think he's dead."
"Nope, just talk to him on the radio. He is on his way up, and he has Darnay's skull as a souvenir."
"How?" I asked in surprise. My spirit lifted upon hearing that bit of news.
"Like I said, Earl is the best hunter alive. Don't worry about it. I'm just glad you're okay. I thought for sure that you were dead."
She paused.
"That was really brave. Stupid, but brave. Thank you."
I blushed. "No big deal." She patted my arm.
"I've got to go inspect the cargo and make sure nothing is damaged before I contact the clients. You stay here and get some food and something to drink. You look like crap."
She signaled for a few of the others to go with her. Nobody was going to go anywhere alone on this tub. I watched her walk away. Even coated in dried vampire juices, she was the prettiest girl I had ever known. Tripp interrupted my reverie by handing me a Gatorade and a power bar. I scarfed them down as he gave me the blow-by-blow of their last vampire encounter. I sat on a crate of grenades and listened to my friends. What it all came down to was this. It did not matter what high-tech gear we had, or what weapons, or even what training. It came down to the friends that stood by our side, and our will to fight for them. It felt really good to be alive right then. I would stand with these people any day, and I knew that they would stand by me. I started to tell them about my close encounter with Darnay when I heard a voice. I stopped instantly, leaving the others regarding me curiously. Lumbering to my feet, I limped with resolute purpose in the direction of that voice. The smarmy, prideful movie star voice. I bent my head from side to side and cracked my neck and back, an old habit that I had picked up in my bouncing days. I used to do that before beating down rowdy drunks. "Hey, Grant," I said coolly as I approached him.
"Pitt, I'm glad you made it.
Look, I'm really sorry, but..." I cut him off. I was closing distance. I did not want him to run because I didn't think I could catch him.
"Grant, you left me to die."
"Wait just a second." He lifted his hands defensively. "It isn't like that. They would have gotten me, too. If I left that hatch open, we would both be dead." I tried to look non-violent. That is difficult when you are a hulking, scar-faced brute of a man. I kept slowly closing distance. The hunters from Boone's team that had been speaking with him sensed serious trouble and backed away.
"You left me behind."
I was directly in front of him now. The railing was to his back, and he had nowhere to go. He must have sensed what was coming because he tried to duck. It did not work. I felt great satisfaction as his nose broke with an audible crunch under my meaty fist. His legs buckled and he started to fall. I grabbed him by his neck guard and jerked him around until he was facing me. Blood was streaming down his face. He tried to perform an Aikido wrist lock to break my grasp, but I was far too strong and angry to fall for that. I slammed him backwards into the railing.
"Do you know how to swim?"
I asked coldly.
"Pitt, it wasn't my fault. Please, wait,"
he begged. I punched him solidly again, this time in the mouth, smashing his lips and cracking a few teeth. My cup was not exactly overflowing with mercy.
"I said, do you know how to swim?"
"No, please, I'm sorry."
"You would best be a quick learner, then,"
I said as I lifted him off of his feet and heaved him over the railing. I stepped away, not even bothering to watch him hit the water. That had felt really good. I was not worried about him drowning. In a moment of unusual kindness that surprised even me, I had hit the button to activate the emergency flotation device on his harness before tossing him. I can be a jerk, but I'm no monster. Boone moved in front of me. He did not look happy. All of the other hunters had come running to see what the commotion was about. From the looks on their faces, I was guessing that they had seen Grant take his plunge.
"What the hell was that?" he demanded.
"He left me for dead back there. He left me in a room with a vampire and some whites. He slammed the door in my face. And he apologized before he did it. Son of a bitch is lucky I didn't just shoot him in the head."
The former SF man studied me. He signaled one of his men.
"Throw Jefferson a rope."
"He isn't going to drown." I turned on his CO2 before I tossed him over.
"I'm not worried about him drowning, fucktard. I'm worried that all the white meat in the water has riled up the sharks and they're going to chew on his pompous ass."
Crap. I hadn't thought about sharks. Oh well. I went back to my Gatorade. The sun was setting over the bow of the Antoine Henri. The 14 surviving members of the MHI teams were gathered on the deck in a rough semicircle,
illuminated in our ragged exhaustion by the fading golden rays. Grant Jefferson had been safely retrieved from the water and was standing as far away from me as was possible, with a giant white cotton swab shoved into each nostril. Harbinger had not been happy, and had promised to talk to both of us later. I was not looking forward to that, and I just hoped that it did not end up with me being terminated. Julie had cataloged all of the valuable cargo. None of the artwork had been lost. The others had found her excitedly browsing through an open cargo container filled with priceless art. Not being a connoisseur of painting, all of the French artwork looked like bunches of colored dots to me. She had not been very happy when she had heard about what I did to her boyfriend. The look she gave me had been oddly similar to the one that she had given that first vampire before she had shafted it through the heart. All of the crew and French hunters had been accounted for. Tissue samples had been taken from each individual creature to be sent to the puff offices for confirmation and to begin the bounty paperwork. Between the huge puff reward and the fulfillment of the French contract, it had been a very lucrative day. But it had its price. The body of Jeremiah Roberts had been laid upon an unzipped body bag on the cold steel deck. His neck guard had been torn away, and unlike the neat little puncture holes that most people seem to imagine for vampire bites, the hunter's throat was missing a massive chunk of flesh, leaving a hole from his trachea to his spine. Boone's team stood the closest to the body. This was their business. The rest of us were mere watchers. The man they called Priest said a few words. As it turned out, they called him that because he had been one once upon a time. This was a hunter's funeral, and it was as sacred as any service inside a church. He was the bravest among us, so fearless that regular people would think he was crazy, but not us. We understood him and loved him for it. Jerry was afraid of no man or beast on earth or from hell. I am alive because of him. Our whole team is alive because of him. He is here because he took the brunt of the attack to protect the rest of us. And today was not the first time that he did that, just the time that his luck ran out. We are taught, greater love has no man than this, that he lays down his life for his friends. My friend, our friend, may you rest in peace. Until we meet again in the better place. Amen. Amen, chorused the group as one. Boone stepped forward. His face was streaked where tears had run through the grime on his cheeks. He looked somberly down at his fallen teammate, and then he slowly knelt at his side. The warrior gently touched his friend for the last time. I'm sorry I failed you, Jerry. I'll be seeing you around. I had to avert my eyes because of what I knew was coming next. I was not the only one. The sound of Boone's fighting knife being drawn from its sheath seemed to go on forever. Roberts had been bitten by a vampire. It had to be done. When Boone was finished, the rest of his team helped him to his feet. He cleaned his knife on a rag. Priest zipped up the rubber bag, and the hunter's funeral was over. Chapter 10 Harbinger summoned me to the cargo bay. There were only a handful of us left on the freighter. The Hind had taken the most injured of the hunters, and the Brilliant Mistake had been signaled to return to pick up a few more men and our gear. Surprisingly, the little boat's crew had stayed nearby to help us. Harbinger gave them an extra $20,000 for their trouble, and the admonition to never talk about this unless they wanted the government to pay them a very unpleasant visit. He must have been feeling generous due to the big haul. The director also gave them business cards, along with instructions to contact us if they ever heard of any more monster problems. Since we could not advertise, much of our business came in the form of referrals. Representatives of the French Shipping Corporation were already en route to retrieve their valuable cargo. The remainder of our fee was to be wired to us upon receipt. The Hind was to return for its last pickup shortly. I limped painfully down the stairs into the vast central bay. Each bootfall echoed hollowly through the cavernous room. I had been paralyzed, drowned, beaten, shot with my own gun, partially paralyzed and choked, and I was hungry, tired, and saddened by the loss of some of my favorite guns. If anybody should have been put on that chopper, it was me. However, it seemed that Harbinger wanted to speak privately first. That was not a good sign. Even Grant had been sent back to land to get his nose and teeth checked. Earl Harbinger, Sam Haven, Milo Anderson, and Julie Shackelford stood before a giant orange container, a heavy-duty kind that could be picked up through the opening in the deck by a giant dock crane and set onto a semi-trailer or train. The sheet-metal double doors were hanging open, and the four experienced hunters were gathered at the opening. "Hey," I said as I approached, not that they did not hear me coming, but I couldn't think of what else to say. None of the four looked up. Julie had her arms folded, and she appeared rather cross. Harbinger pointed inside the container.
"What do you make of this, Pitt?"
He shined a flashlight into the interior. There were seven wooden crates inside. Each was long enough and deep enough to easily hold a person. I ducked my head as I entered, pulling out my own flashlight to get a closer look. The air tasted stale. The lids for the crates had been set aside, and the interior seemed to be filled with nothing but dirt. I ran my hands through one. It was a thick, black loam. Another was white particulate sand, and yet another looked almost like Alabama red clay. "Coffins," I said, "for the seven masters in my dream."
"Yep," Harbinger said. "And I'm willing to bet that the dirt is soil from their native lands."
"What does that mean?" Julie asked. "I know I've heard about that in the folk tales, but we've never seen evidence of vampires actually needing to sleep in soil from their homeland."
"Beats me, but this is a really weird bunch. I've never seen anything like this before, and I've never even heard or read about anything like this either."
"We don't know for sure that they are really masters, Earl," Sam said. "We haven't actually seen any of them yet."
"The stronger the creator, the greater the creation. Some of those sailors we killed were way too powerful to be that young, but they were. Plus creating whites as daylight guardians? Darnay was as powerful as a 100-year-old bloodsucker, and he has to have been turned in the last week. Whoever turned him was one bad dude. So there is at least one master in this gang. I would bet on it,"
Harbinger replied.
"So how did you beat Darnay anyway?"
The other hunters glanced at their team leader, curious to hear his response.
"Later. It isn't important right now."
"He was a good guy when he was human," Sam said. "Losing him is a damn shame."
"People change when they are turned. It doesn't matter what they were like before. No matter how good they were when they turn, they come back as pure evil."
Julie trailed off, and then changed the subject.
"We probably need to alert the feds. Seven high-level vamps on U.S. soil? They would shut us down in a second if they found out that we knew and didn't tell them."
"I hate feds."
Milo spoke for the first time. Sam spit on the floor.
"Me too. But they need to mobilize. They're somewhere in Georgia and heading who knows where. I'll call Myers,"
Harbinger told them with a look like he had just bit into something sour.
"They probably won't believe us, though. Hell, I don't believe what I'm saying."
I looked in the other coffins. Thicker sand, rich topsoil, alkali dirt,
and finally broken shale and gravel. I notice something as I shine my light in the back corner.
You guys seen this?
What?
Harbinger asked as he entered and came up next to me. I squatted and pointed at the ground. Something had dissolved all of the paint in the corner. A dark substance coated the floor.
I sure as heck wasn't going to touch it.
It felt unnatural from where I stood, and I had a visceral feeling that it was some sort of secretions from the cloaked and armored monstrosity from my dream. Harbinger knelt and studied it.
Ichor. Looks like snot from somebody with real bad allergies. Let's take a sample.
I breathed a little easier once I was out of the claustrophobic box.
But wait, there's more, Sam stated. I saw this earlier when we were getting set to blow the steam pipe. Check this shit out.
He took us to another shipping container. This one appeared normal until we circled it and saw what was on the other side. The steel walls had been pierced and peeled back from the inside. I touched one of the edges. The steel was a quarter inch thick, and the reinforced tubing around the edges had been easily bent.
Wow, Milo said, stroking his beard absently. No sign of explosion or cutting torch or anything like that. Something just punched its way through. Isn't that special?
Yeah, it just frickin' warms my heart, Sam said.
Why can't we ever fight cute, helpless monsters, like the ones on Sesame Street?
The big things from my dream, I said. They could have done this. They had to be at least 10 feet tall, and they could fly. They had huge wingspans. They were ugly, and they had horns and big teeth and claws. That was about all I saw because I was just moving too fast.
The four hunters surrounded me.
Now start from the beginning and tell us the whole story about this dream, Harbinger ordered.
So that's why you brought me down here. I thought you were going to yell at me for beating up Grant, I replied cheerfully.
Julie folded her arms and glared.
Harbinger shook his head.
Oh, don't worry, I'll get to that. But business first. From the beginning. Tell us every single detail you can think of, even things that you might not think are important.
We might as well get comfortable. This is going to take a while.
I told the whole story, starting with my initial dream in the hospital. I tried to convey the weirdness of it, and probably failed. I went into as much detail as I could about the next dream. I did not, however, tell them about seeing the old man when I had been underwater. I was still not sure if that had actually happened, or if it had been a panic trick of my oxygen-starved brain. When I was finished, the others began to drill me with questions, only some of which I could answer.
The head vampire called the old man Barika?
As near as I could tell, something like that.
Could he be a wraith? Maybe a revenant, even? Julie asked. No, wait, those have bodies. How about a shade?
Beats me.
There is a possibility, Harbinger stated. I've heard some weird stories since I've been doing this kind of thing. He could be a ghost, and he could have hooked up with you while you were dead on the operating table. You might have actually met him on the other side and brought him back. Now he's using you somehow. Problem is, we don't know jack about ghosts, so how do we figure out why he's trying to help you?
Be sure to ask him that the next time you see him, Milo told me.
Except I only see him when I'm dead, or about to come close to death, I added sardonically.
That will be convenient for you, then. You're a monster hunter now. Plenty of good opportunities to die all of the time.
The ocean rushed by below. The interior of the hind was very loud, and that was not helped by the fact that our pilot felt the need to blare heavy metal through the intercom. Excellent selection, though. Disturbed, Slipknot, Rob Zombie, and even the latest single by my brother's band. I figured I would have to let the pilot know that I knew Cabbage Point Killing Machine's guitarist once we landed. I had not met the pilot yet,
and all that I had been told about him was when Milo had jokingly said that he had been included in the purchase of the chopper. I had no idea what that was supposed to mean. All that I had seen so far had been the back of his helmeted head. I had never ridden in a helicopter before, and it was kind of exciting. Loud and with painful vibrations, but still fun. Almost like a roller coaster ride with the added advantage that it could shear a bolt and kill you in a matter of seconds. We were sitting in the cramped crew compartment. The Hind had originally been used to move Russian infantry, though this particular specimen had been tweaked and customized extensively by MHI. It was still tight, but I was given to understand that it was downright plush compared to what it had once been. Almost all of the other hunters had immediately gone to sleep. They understood the basic principle of sleep when you can, because you don't know when you are going to get to do it again. I couldn't do it, so I passed the time by picking silver buckshot pellets out of my armor. I made a mental note to add Milo Anderson to my Christmas card list. I held up one of the silver pellets, now deformed from the impact, and studied it, deep in thought. I had almost died today. Now that the adrenaline had left my system, I found my exhausted brain once again pondering just what the hell I was doing. And truthfully, I didn't have an answer. Julie's head was rolled to the side, and she was snoring. She had hardly spoken to me since she had found out about my little altercation with Grant. I was not about to apologize. He had left me to get eaten, and I did not like that one bit. Harbinger opened his eyes. He had been awake. He checked to make sure Julie was out, and then unbuckled his seatbelt and moved next to me, flopping solidly into the uncomfortable chair. He turned and shouted in my ear.
"I wanted to talk to you about Grant."
"Okay,"
I shouted back.
"I know about what happened.
He left me behind to save his own skin."
"I know,"
he yelled. It was hard to have a conversation by shouting.
"Grant says that he didn't think he could save you, that you would both have been killed."
"Perhaps." I did not respond, not knowing what to say, and not wanting to admit that Grant very well might have been right, and honestly not really knowing what I would have done if our situations had been reversed.
"Don't ever let something like that happen again. I'm the boss. I take care of discipline. You undermine my authority."
"That's it? You aren't mad at me for hitting him?"
"Oh, if I was mad, you'd be swimming home."
"Serious?"
I asked. Earl sighed and rubbed his face.
"What are you going to do with him?"
I asked.
"Huh? What are you going to do with Grant?"
I said, turning up the volume.
"I don't know yet. Maybe Grant's right and he would have died keeping that door open, and I don't believe in committing suicide to prove a point."
"Sam said something about it being easier to be brave when others are watching you. Maybe Grant isn't so tough when there aren't any witnesses,"
I insisted.
"Yeah, Sam's a regular philosopher," Earl responded. "You can face some really scary shit and be just fine as long as you're doing it for your team."
He grew suddenly serious, and I had to look away from those cold eyes.
"Either way, it ain't none of your business now. Don't ever do something like that again. Hunters can't lose control. Got that? You never lose control. Do you have a problem with that?"
"No, sir."
We sat in silence for a few minutes, listening to the rotors beat the air, and some amazing guitar playing by my brother. From the expression on Harbinger's face, I don't think that he cared for metal. I refrained from banging my head, in deference to his tender sensibilities.
"What about Julie?"
I asked.
"What about her?
Does she believe that Grant abandoned me?"
"None of my business. She's a grown-up."
The look he gave me told me to shut it. He quickly changed the subject.
"Let me ask you this, Pitt. You've been with us for a few months. You've gone on exactly one mission. Could you leave now and go back to your spreadsheets and your tax forms?
I did not answer. Did Earl know how much I was doubting the path that I was on? He was the experienced one. Maybe he could see what I could not.
Well, you'll probably need to.
My heart sank. So this was it. Was he going to let me go because of my rash actions? If he felt he could not trust me, then I would be out. Did he think that I was too hot-headed and impulsive to be a member of the team?
I got a letter yesterday. The IRS is going to audit us. I'm going to need your help. Our books are a mess. Once we handle this little vampire problem, of course.
I grinned. That I could handle.
I can deal with the IRS. They're a little easier than vampires. Not much, but a little. Will sunlight banish them? Maybe. I haven't tried that before. That's just the tip of the iceberg, though. OSHA is crawling all over us for, I kid you not, workplace safety violations, as if there is anything safe about what we do at all. The EPA is angry about some of the pollution we have caused by burning certain kinds of monsters. Fish and Wildlife wants to fine us for killing a giant mutant Tennessee River catfish because it was endangered. Sure, it had just crawled up on land and eaten some teenagers, but it was still an endangered species. We're in trouble with the BATF for some missing compliance paperwork for the machine guns and explosives, paperwork which they lost, and Immigration is investigating us for employing some illegal aliens.
Are we?
Sure, but who doesn't? Do you think you just put an ad in the paper for people who can fly Russian attack helicopters?
Why are the feds hammering us?
We've pissed a lot of people off in Washington. Our company was shut down for a long time. Puff was only reactivated by the slimmest of margins. There are a lot of bureaucrats who are itching for us to fail. They're making it damn near impossible to get our jobs done.
So what are we going to do?
Harbinger grinned savagely.
From the amount of money we made on this job, I'm going to buy me some congressmen, maybe even a senator.
I was shocked.
Are you talking about bribery?
Why? Does that offend you?
He asked.
Oh, hell no. I'm a libertarian at heart. Screw 'em.
Chapter 11. That night I dreamed again, but it was not about my apparent friend, the old man with the poor English, nor was it about the cursed one and his gang of abominations. This was something different. A lone mountain rose out of a bleak, dead forest. The side of the peak had been torn asunder in some sort of huge explosion. Trees had been shattered, stripped of their bark, or bent to the earth. Rock was charred and broken. The very foundations of the mountain had been cracked, and the face of the mighty peak had collapsed in an avalanche. Among the shale and gravel was a low spot where the rubble had settled into what had once been a natural cavern, or perhaps an underground structure. In the deepest depression, small bits of gravel and dust began to stir as something pushed against them from underneath, gradually and laboriously moving the weight of the earth above. Finally, a dirt-encrusted hand thrust its way into the air, followed by a massively muscled arm. The torn and bloodied fingers clenched into an angry fist. It was covered in black, swirling tattoos. I woke up the next morning, groggy, sore, and cranky. We were staying at the bug-infested Radio City Motor Lodge in some little Georgia town that made Cazador look like a thriving metropolis. It had been the closest lodging to the dirt strip it passed for the local airport. It is hard to sleep when roaches keep skittering across your body. My understanding is that since roaches can't shift into reverse,
If one of them crawls into your ear canal, it can get really nasty and potentially kill you. Sleep on that. The injured hunters had been dispersed to seek medical care. The cargo plane had dropped off Boone's two injured men at their home city of Atlanta. Robert's body had gone with them. The plane had then continued west, delivering Albert Lee and his fractured rib back to Alabama. Grant Jefferson had flown the plane. He had been sent back to the compound supposedly to take over and continue the newbie's training. I figured that I probably needed some medical care as well, but Harbinger wanted to keep me around because of my dreams, and also possibly because he worried that I might murder Grant once I was left unsupervised. So that left 10 of us in coastal Georgia. 11 if you counted our mysterious helicopter pilot, who had apparently slept in the chopper. I still had not seen the man without his face-shielding helmet, and he never seemed to speak. The experienced hunters seemed used to the odd behavior and did not even bother to remark upon it. There had only been 3 available rooms. The ladies had taken the nicest one, meaning that the toilet worked, and there were not as many unidentifiable spots on the walls. I had bunked with Tripp, Meade, and Milo. Taking pity on me because of the beating I had received, they gave me one of the twin beds. Milo had seniority, so he got the other. Tripp had won a game of rock, paper, scissors. Of course, Chuck went rock to get the couch. Meade got to sleep on the carpet with the mystery stains. We gathered in Harbinger's room not long after dawn. A large map of Georgia had been purchased and was stuck to the wall with someone's throwing knives. Julie and Boone both had powerful laptops open and running. Boxes of our gear and munitions had been hastily piled into the corners. We had hired a flatbed to move it from the docks to here. The group was sitting around in their shorts and T-shirts, all except for the newbie squad, who had not known to bring any clothing other than our armor. Holly had borrowed some clothing from Julie. Tripp and Chuck had stolen some from somebody else. Since I was the only 4XL, I stood in the corner wearing my boxer shorts and a towel for modesty. I had hosed the undead juices off my armor. The suit was still drying in the shower.
"Pitt, this is an informal meeting. You shouldn't dress up so much," Sam told me.
At least he didn't try to steal my towel and flick me with it. I could tell he was tempted.
"Okay, everybody, here's the situation," Harbinger began, a cigarette dangling unlit from his lips. "We have 7 very powerful vampires, possibly masters, that landed somewhere near here, along with some other monsters of unknown type. They must have arrived sometime in the last 3 days. If they launched as soon as the freighter turned south down the coast, they would have arrived near Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, though my gut feeling's that they didn't do that. The ship dropped anchor off this coast for a reason. If they came straight to shore, they would have landed in this area east of us."
He put his finger on a spot of coastline. There were a lot of islands, peninsulas, and inlets under that fingertip.
"If they started moving as soon as they landed, they could be almost anywhere. They could still be on foot, or they could have secured some transportation. If they're in a vehicle, then they could be in Florida, Alabama, or South Carolina by now."
"Vampires can drive?" Chuck asked blankly.
"Yes, Meade, vampires can drive, just not during daylight. If they secured a truck with a trailer, it would give them a place to sleep during the daylight hours, too."
"What if they split up?" Milo asked.
"They won't," I answered. 9 heads swiveled in my direction. I tried to cover myself with the towel as best I could. I was a little self-conscious, especially with all of the thick red scar tissue on my chest and back.
"They're like a protective detail. The cursed one is their principal. They're guarding him. Wherever he goes, they go."
"Yeah, about that. I've been meaning to ask. How do we know you aren't just bloody nuts?" Priest asked.
"No offense intended."
"None taken,"
To be honest, I don't know. But the 7 coffins is a pretty good indicator.
Fair enough, he answered.
What about this cursed one? Do we have anything on record about that?
Milo asked.
Negative. I can't find anything. Lots of things with curses, but not that match this one. Nothing comes up in a search, and nothing under Lord Machado. No entries about anything wearing a suit of armor, either. Got a bunch of folks hitting the books back at the compound looking for something. There might be something in the old archives that hasn't been scanned in yet.
MHI kept meticulous records of all known monster encounters, and also drew upon a massive library of information gathered from around the world. The stuff that we dealt with did not just pop up during a Google search.
Maybe if we had a better description, it might help, Julie said coldly.
She was still pretty mad at me.
Sorry, I was incorporeal at the time.
Machado is a Portuguese last name. It means axe, like the kind that an executioner would use, Sam told us. His useful information was a bit of a surprise. His teammates regarded him strangely. The cowboy spent a lot more time busting heads than he did studying monster history.
What? I had a master chief with that last name. He thought the axe thing was pretty cool.
We're listening to the local police bands. If we're lucky, somebody will see something and call it in. If we're unlucky, somebody's going to end up as lunch. So we are also listening for any missing persons reports. This is Boone's turf, so he's trying to contact some of the locals who might be first in line for information.
First in line? Holly queried.
Cops, coroners, reporters. In this case, I'm going to contact hookers, pimps, and drug dealers. Also some backwoods hill folk that I've dealt with before. When vampires feed, they usually go after the underbelly of society. They keep off the radar that way.
How often do they need to feed? Tripp asked. Unknown. The usual low-level vamps that we deal with seem to do it every chance they get, with probably a minimum of about once a month. I know that the feds have captured a few in the past and done testing on them, even starved a few, but they don't share that kind of info with us, Julie said.
Speaking of the feds, I had to call them, Harbinger said sadly.
He paused during the inevitable cursing long enough to light his cigarette and take a long drag.
Didn't have much of a choice. We're still short-handed. We have to face the fact that we might not be able to tackle all of them, especially if they're roaming together.
What did they say? Milo asked.
Nothing, basically. They said thanks for the tip. That was it. I think they thought I was nuts.
We can handle them, Earl. We don't need no feds, Sam said.
Maybe if we catch them while they're sleeping and toss in a couple 100 pounds of C4.
Facing them while they're awake? No way.
There was some murmuring at that. We were a testosterone-charged, confident, well-trained team.
No offense, but I'm the only person here who has actually killed a master. I'm one of the only people alive who has even seen one. And I was just lucky. Trust me on this one. We're good, but we ain't that good. If we find them, we wait until they hole up, and then we blow it to hell with bombs or napalm or something. Face to face, no thanks.
Who else can we call in? Boone asked.
Julie played with her laptop for a minute.
Closest other hunters are Hurley's team out of Miami, but they're on a case in the Bahamas.
Lucky bastards, Sam grunted.
Nope, they're tracking Aluska.
She shuddered.
Oh, never mind, he said quickly.
I did not know what Aluska was, but if Sam or Julie did not want to mess with one, neither did I.
After that, the only other MHI personnel in the South are Boone's guys, and then the newbies and a few others at the compound. I don't think we want to call up Grandpa or Dorcas. Going out from there, we have 2 teams in the Northeast, both on cases right now in New York and Baltimore. Next closest after that is Phillips, who's currently dealing with some devil monkeys in St. Paul. Only 5 other teams left.
And they're out west or out of the country. Every single team is working a case. We need to speed up the training process, Milo suggested.
I know. But it doesn't do any good to train them fast if they just get killed on their first mission. Julie, send every team a message. Give them a brief summary about what we're probably facing, and tell them that if we beep them, they need to drop whatever they're doing and get here as quick as they possibly can. This takes precedence over anything.
Because of the danger to people? Asked Trip, always looking out for the little guy, being the team's resident good Samaritan and idealist.
No, because the bounty on a master vampire is frickin' huge, Sam said.
How huge are we talking about? Asked Holly.
We had been told that our next bi-monthly check would probably hover around $20,000 for our cut of the action from the Antoine Henri. I couldn't wait to see what the year-end bonus looked like.
Like we could buy Idaho kind of money. Back to business. Here's the plan. We break up into groups. One group stays here at base, monitors communications, and checks all of the gear. Boone will take a group and start hitting up his sources.
Priest can take a group also. He knows the same people I do. We can cover more ground that way. Some of those folks are not the kind of people that you can just get on the phone.
Good. Final group takes the chopper. I'll head up and down the coastline looking for that little boat or where it might have possibly landed. Pitt comes with me and we will see if we can't identify anything from his dream.
What do we do about cars? Meade asked.
Head into town. Buy some from the locals. Let Milo do it. He's our best scrounger. We have two suitcases full of money, so try to get something nice.
And I had wondered why we had IRS troubles. We threw cash around like the Cali cartel.
Oh, and somebody, for the love of all that is holy, buy Pitt a pair of pants.
The hind sat on the broken tarmac, looking like a squat and angry amphibian. I jumped out of the back of the pickup and just barely had time to grab my gear before the truck roared off and sprayed me with gravel and dust. Milo was having entirely too much fun with the jacked-up 4x4 that he had just bought off a local named, and I'm not making this up, Cooter. There were even naked lady silhouettes on the mud flaps, and a little sticker of Calvin peeing on a Ford symbol in the back window. Harbinger and I headed toward the chopper. We were wearing normal clothing, concealing only handguns, with our more serious gear shoved into the duffel bags that both of us were lugging. The pistol that I had under my shirt had belonged to Roberts. It was a big, stainless steel Smith & Wesson 4506. Not my style, but it was available, and he was not using it anymore. It sure beat being unarmed. Milo had picked me up some regular clothes at the nearest country store. The only shirt they had in my size was lime green and was emblazoned with the deep philosophy of no fat chicks. Our pilot was waiting for us. I finally got to see him without his helmet. Unfortunately, he was wearing a black balaclava and tinted goggles. Harbinger waved as we approached. The pilot waved back.
So what's the deal with the pilot?
What do you mean?
I mean, it's already 80 degrees out here and he's wearing a ski mask.
Oh, he's just shy is all.
We stopped in front of the chopper. I held up my hand and introduced myself. The pilot tilted his head to the side and studied my hand. I gradually lowered it and finally put it in my pocket, slightly embarrassed.
Well, he's foreign. Weird customs, you know. A bit antisocial.
Right. Nice to meet you, Mr. The pilot grumbled something guttural and incomprehensible. Sounded like gibberish to me. I looked to my boss.
It means skull-crushing battle hand of fury in his language. We call him Skippy.
Harbinger seemed to be enjoying himself.
Saves on time that way.
I was told he came with the chopper?
Kind of. It's a long story. I met him in Uzbekistan. His tribe came.